This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that has an ass in its cock. This is the movie dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, but from now on, I want to leave that name behind and to be referred to as Kirk Kegler.
Hey, this is Chris, and I gotta go wash my vagina.
In this episode, we're discussing Boogie Nights, starring Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, Burt Reynolds, Don Cheadle, John C. Reilly, William H. Macy, Heather Graham, Nicole Ari Parker, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Luis Guzman, Philip Baker Hall, Thomas Jane, Robert Ridgely, Melora Walters, Afra Molina, and Ricky Jay, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. Gentlemen, this is one of those movies, yet again, that I'm thinking, we are 4 years into Art House Legends, yet we have not yet done a Paul Thomas Anderson film. What the fuck, gentlemen? Actually, maybe that's not the right word to use for this movie.
No, it's perfect for this movie.
There's going to be a lot of fucking in this movie. But out of curiosity, though, what is your familiarity with Paul Thomas Anderson? What movies of his have you seen, and how did you come to this movie?
You know what's weird is looking at, I've known the name Paul Thomas Anderson for ages, and I'm looking at the list of what he's directed, and I'm like, have I actually seen any of this? And I don't think I have. Which is just bizarre.
I don't believe it either
after looking at this. It's like, wait, I know this? I should know this?
Yeah. Well, what about you, Chris? I mean, you're a film critic. I'm pretty sure that you've seen some of Paul Thomas Anderson's
I've seen,
work.
I guess, most of it. I haven't seen Heartache or Magnolia. So, yeah. And I've seen...
Okay, then you need to come over to my place for a double feature stat. No, I'm going to say right now that I actually, when it came out in theaters, I actually tried to stay far away from this movie because at that particular point, to me, it just felt like it was going to be one of those movies that just glorified porn. And while I was a teenager who enjoyed porn, I also didn't think that this was going to be high cinema. I just thought it was just going to be just kind of an artsy-fartsy porn movie, and with actors and actresses that I probably didn't really want to see naked. And it was only when the DVD craze had come to a head, no pun intended, that I just decided to buy this movie, just thinking, well, what the hell? I mean, if anything, it's got some boobs. And that would start my love affair with Paul Thomas Anderson. At that particular point, after watching this movie, I didn't just watch Paul Thomas Anderson films. I sought them out. I would make sure that every time that his movies came out, I was there opening weekend. I've even gone to special sneak screenings of films, of his films, just so that I can see them as quickly as humanly possible. I have seen Heartache, or as he calls it, Sydney, which is his official title. He was forced to change it because of studio, thinking that some people would think that this is about Australia for some reason. I have seen Punch Drunk Love. I have seen There Will Be Blood. I saw Inherent Vice, The Master, and Magnolia is one of my all-time favorite films. So, yeah. I have a deep affinity for Paul Thomas Anderson's work, and quite honestly, I can't believe that it's been 20 years since this movie has come out. But it's also kind of interesting seeing all the actors that are in this movie and how many of these actors will be like huge in the coming decades. right? I mean, some of these people, you know, I'm pretty sure that even you, Ken, are very familiar with quite a few of this cast. And we're not talking about just Art House Legends movies that you've seen these in, right?
Yeah, I mean, if we hit the geek sheet right now, we'd be seeing a lot of stuff from other things, so...
Let's put it this way. Almost half the cast has been in a Marvel movie at some point.
I wouldn't go for half, but a reasonable percentage. So,
All right. So, I guess let's start off and let's talk about the subject of the film itself, which is the pornographic scene in the late 70s and early 80s. Now, maybe I shouldn't be asking this question so candidly, but let's go ahead and let's put it out there. Have you seen any of the porn or are familiar of the porn of the late 70s?
I was a teenager of the 80s, so yeah.
All right. So you want to elaborate a little bit?
That is true about one of the plot points of this film that they bring up pretty much between acts, is that, whereas 1980 hits, the shift to video, definitely, because I've seen stuff from the 70s, and stuff from the 80s, and there is a definite shift there. The 70s, you could tell, was more of a let's make a film kind of attitude towards it. Of course, I'm basing this pretty much just on one or two things that I ended up finding. Flesh Gordon. Actual movie, look it up. And compared to the 80s, which was really just no plot stuff going on. Really. So, or bad parody. How about you? You seen anything from that period?
Chris?
No. I have a very easy answer. Mine is a lot less, interesting. It's
you
no.
You guys are so. Of the 90s. Yeah, 90s vintage.
Well, okay, so I will go ahead and put out the caveat that I am not super familiar of the porn of the late 70s and early 80s, although I am aware of it. I guess I can say that I have seen half of Deep Throat. I have come across old porn. Again, maybe I shouldn't be saying this because, maybe this is putting out a little bit too much information, but... But the thing is that as a kind of moment in time, I also find it very interesting because, like, we talked about Taxi Driver, and porn kind of played a part in that movie. There have been other movies that have dealt with porn either as kind of a doomed existence. I want to think of Hardcore with George C. Scott kind of coming to mind, as a man who was trying to find his daughter who had gotten herself into the porn industry. So to me, it's interesting to see a movie that's surrounding this movie or surrounding this particular scene, yet it's not one that is ultimately looking at it from a place of derision. It's not looking at it as a... with any kind of moral superiority. And that's something very interesting, considering when this movie came out and how the movie has aged since then and how I look at this film then and how I look at this film now. But I guess it also should be noted that, Boogie Nights is actually a remake of sorts, because Paul Thomas Anderson, at the age of 17, with his best friend, who we actually see in this movie, made the Dirk Diggler story, which was a video. It's kind of a mockumentary of sorts in the vein of This is Spinal Tap, with Paul Thomas Anderson and his best friend talking about the life of porn star Dirk Diggler. And I haven't seen that because Paul Thomas Anderson decided not to put that as a special feature in his DVD or Blu-ray of Boogie Nights. And I say, shame on you, sir, for telling us about this mockumentary and not allowing us to see it for ourselves. Just shame on you. But at the same time, though, I have to admit, this would be an interesting mockumentary, right? I mean, we kind of see it a little bit. And I think that the documentary that we see halfway through the film is kind of a callback to that mockumentary. But what do you think?
The real What We Do in the Shadow. No. What's that, a documentary being filmed in the... I thought it was just interviews for, like, just TV or whatever.
Well, it is. Well, it is interviews, and it shows behind the scenes of his work. It's kind of a loving tribute to Dirk Diggler. Although, well, as we talk about, well, we'll get into that a little bit later. But yeah, it's how do we? I don't know. I'm having a hard time kind of explaining my thoughts on it. But what about you, Chris? What do you take away from a mockumentary style of this particular movie? Not your bag.
I don't know if I'd be interested in seeing that. I don't know. I guess I'd have to see like a.
Especially if Paul Thomas Anderson came back.
If it was Paul Thomas Anderson, I'd watch him if he was like, "Hey, I'm going to film a movie with the lens cap on," and I'd be like, "Hey, I'm there, man. Bring it."
Oh boy. I would say that I think he did that for half of The Master. Hey-o!
Soon.
Okay. We'll, at some point, we will talk about The Master at some point, I'm pretty sure, after we're done with all of them Tarantino films. All right, but... Okay, so... This movie, while it is set in the backdrop of the 70s porn scene, it's also interesting that this movie is ultimately a story about family.
Yeah. No.
Right? I mean, we can all agree that this is a movie about a family. Any disagreement on that?
No, it feels nope. Like a family. Yeah.
And I also love how we get to know all the members of this family, and that the film is interested in all the members of the family. And I think the way that the movie sets up that this is a family is ultimately in the first shot of the movie itself. Because can I just say how much I love this tracking shot at the beginning of the film? I absolutely love it. This is the first time I fell in love with a tracking shot is this shot. In fact, it was one of those that I didn't catch on that it was a tracking shot the first time I saw it. But going back to the movie, I kind of realized just how beautiful and how it moved and how it set up all the characters that we really need to know in the span of about, 7 minutes? 8 minutes?
Less than that.
I mean, you know, and it's set to this great music. I love it. I love how, you know, we get the title of the movie, and then we pan over to the street, and we come to our first set of characters, which is Jack Horner and Amber Waves, and... Of course, how can we not just gush over the fireball that is Luis Guzman?
Yeah.
Come on. Please tell me I'm not alone in just absolute love of this amazing actor who...
No, he's great.
He seems to be everywhere and yet gets very little love. It's just saying. Come on. Come on, Chris. You gotta give some love to Luis, right? In fact, I love the fact that he's the one who gets the first line in the movie.
I mean, I thought he was just all right, so yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
He's just a fireball of excitement. I mean, the first time he says, Jack! I mean, he sets things up. His club is kind of this hub of everything that's going on in Reseda. And, you know, he knows everybody. He's good with everybody. He's got a lot of charisma. He's kind of setting things in motion. You know, he's always trying to set himself up as, you know, getting into the movies and getting to be a porn star himself, even though...
No.
No. Yeah. No. I will say, as much as I love Luis Guzman, I do not want to see little Luis. Just saying. But or who knows? Maybe this big Luis, you know what they say. But seriously though, I mean the way that it goes to the club, you know, it sets up kind of the dynamic about Jack and Amber. It's kind of this they're in a relationship, right? We never see them have sex, but we get the sense that they are an item right from the beginning. Can we agree to that?
In a sense, they seem like they're like a couple, but like,
not.
It's weird, like, yeah.
Well, their whole relationship has this weird, we're professional, but kind of thing going.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is that he, you know, he treats her with more respect than I think he treats any other woman in this movie. Right, all the other women that he deals with on a just professional level. She's always at his side whenever they're going out. He comforts her. He puts her at a position of importance over other actors and actresses to an extent. We don't ever see him go out of his way to defend her honor, but I think it's because he respects her enough to know that she can deal with things herself. Right?
Kind of. Because, like, she may have needed some help with the whole kid situation. So...
Well, you got a point there. And it's one of those things that I get the sense that Jack, he's there for her when she falls, but he doesn't ever help her to get up. Because it's pretty clear that she has a cocaine problem. Mm-hmm. And it's a problem that gets worse, and we never see him address it, but he always gives her a place to stay. So it's you get the sense that he is there for her in his own way. But Jack is not exactly father of the year, so to say, even though technically speaking he is the father of this little family. I mean, these are very flawed characters. These are very short-sighted characters. And I think that this time around when I saw the movie, I didn't exactly understand just how short-sighted these characters are. All of them are thinking about short-term. They don't think about the long-term consequences of their actions. They don't think about what is, you know, what the outcome is going to be for all the things that they're doing and how this quick money that they're getting, right?
Well, Jack Het is the only one with any form of long-term belief, but his is more legacy. It's like, I'm going to create this art, and it's going to last, but beyond that, it's like, he doesn't care.
But does he really... the question is, does he really, though? Because, quite honestly, you know, even when he's talking about doing this kind of whole artistic thing, the closest thing that he gets to art is a knockoff of James Bond. Or not even James Bond. It seems like he's doing Starsky and Hutch the porno.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, that's his idea of a genuine, real movie. You know, I mean, and let's just put it this way. At around the same time, Larry Flint financed Caligula. Okay? You know, he got the star of of A Clockwork Orange to become, you know, to act as the most insane and audacious Roman emperor, you know, and it was total shit. I mean, it's a shitty movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I would never recommend it, but it is a shit show.
Well, you make it sound great.
You will see. But all the same, though, the thing is that was a pornographer who is aiming for art as much as he could see it. Horner, I don't think he ever really tried. I think that he was more interested in making money, but it was one of those things where it's that short-sightedness. He doesn't play the long game, as we'll see when it comes to the whole VHS thing. he doesn't accept maybe who he is, but he never fully commits to an artistic life, so to say, right? I that's kind of the only way I can see that particular arc. But I mean, I think the thing is like, I want to talk about Buck in the sense with this, with Don Cheadle's character, because, you know, he does have a long-term game, but the problem is that he self-deludes himself into thinking that how he got the money he did wasn't going to come back and bite him in the ass, right?
Yeah.
But I get, but the thing is that we have a whole lot of characters here, and it'll be very difficult if we go through all the different characters. But I guess let's go ahead and let's get into who we're really here for, because at the end of this long tracking shot, after we find out about Jack and Amber, we also meet Roller Girl, Heather Graham. And Heather Graham, have either of you seen her prior to this movie? I mean, I guess you can, because this is your first time, right?
I mean, I've seen her in Austin Powers. She was in TV series Scrubs for a while. So I'm familiar with quite a few things she's done.
What, Lost
in
Space?
I did see that.
Which came out the year after.
I was blanking out the existence, but yes, thank you for reminding me.
Well, just look at it this way. You don't have to talk about her on the Geek Show now, don't you?
Well, she's still...
But at the same time, though, it's like, you know, we're setting up that she has kind of a that she's kind of a child, not just in the sense that she's a young woman, but she's also the way that she is talking to Amber, you get a kind of a familiar element. And then, of course, our last main character is going to be Eddie, right?
Yeah.
Marky Mark for all those 90s hip hop fans out there. And Academy Award nominee. This is going to be interesting to talk about.
Wait.
We'll get to that. We will get to that. All right, but what do we think about this introduction to Eddie? The way that Jack sees him, the conversation between Jack and Eddie that sets up everything. What do you make of Eddie from the beginning?
Young, inexperienced, a little naive, but...
Well, I mean, he has enough experience that he's willing to ask for a five or a ten.
That's kind of the surprise. It's like, this happens already this often? Like, what?
He's at a nightclub, so I mean, it's kind of... Yeah. That kind of makes sense. But at the same time, it's like, you're 17? Fucking flashing your dick about, man? What are you doing? You know, and...
Well, you know how much $10 was back then, though.
Yeah, seriously.
He's making good... He's making a night's wages just by doing that, so...
Yeah.
But it's just... Of course, what's interesting, though, is does Jack look at him and go, well, that's an interesting face, let me talk to him, or was he tipped off?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, he sees a guy doing dishes, like, he's got a big cock. He has, like, fucking spider sense for dicks, or what?
But he does seem surprised when he's like, well, five if you just want to see it. Like, wait, what? There's something that's going on here? No, well, it's more like, there's something going on here? Am I right about something?
Well, no, I think Jack knows what's going on in this club, but I also think whenever he's talking about the 5 or 10, I think Jack looks at him and he's thinking, you're thinking way too low of yourself.
That too.
You're undervaluing something. Because, what's the last thing he says to Jack before he to Eddie before he walks out, which is that I think there's something in those pants that is just waiting to come out. You know, he's basically saying that he sees a star in him, that he sees someone that he can exploit. And I mean that in actually good way here, or in a way that Jack sees as good and that Eddie would probably also see as good. You know, because at this particular point, you know, we get the sense that adult movies isn't considered smut. It isn't considered to be derogatory. Eddie doesn't treat pornography as derogatory. It's just another art form, right? It's erotic art form. Do we kind of get that sense about it, or Do you think that he thinks low of pornography?
I don't think he thinks low of it. He just may not think he's up for it, unless he's actually going to this club to try and meet a pornographer to get into the business.
No. We get the sense that although it is interesting because there are clubs
in his town.
Out where he...
So he's trying to get into some business. Maybe get discovered by legitimate.
Yeah.
But
he's showing to have ambition. And maybe that's what Jack sees in him. And, you know, that this is an ambitious kid. He might have the ability to rise to the occasion. Again, no pun intended. I think I'm going to have to start putting up a pun jar that I'm going to have to give to John a Lobster the next time I see him. But...
Well, at least I'm not yelling, that's what she said, after every one of these, because it's too easy.
Don't do that. All right, let me put this. Every time you see that, that's what she says. She had to put a dollar in the pun jar as well.
Yeah.
That's your sin. That's your sin. But I love that this all sets up, and that afterwards we see how everyone goes home. Yeah. We see how Jack and Amber and their kind of night routine. We find out about Amber's child, and we get the sense that there's a sense that there's problems with custody. We get how Eddie comes home, and you know, he has this overburdening mother and this kind of weakling father, and we, you know, kind of his normal routine, right? We meet his little girlfriend who loves smoking dope and, you know, fucking, you know, very simple pleasures for the 70s.
There was more going on in the 70s than that.
Well, well, I mean, we did talk about this Days and Confused a little bit. But also another interesting thing is that he also kind of comes back to this mentioning that he's going to be a huge star. I think it's also very interesting that he sees his only talent being his penis.
Yeah.
I think that's, and again, maybe you're onto something, Kent, about him going out there specifically to get into pornography. But if that's the case, then why didn't he jump straight at it when Jack offers it to him? I mean, he will take it later, but when it seems like he has no other choice. Or no, I mean, he does have the audition before then. But it is really interesting that he declines Jack's first offer. And it doesn't, like, let's put it this way. Eddie is not exactly what you call a deep thinker. He is not a long game person. He is not a grand strategian of any sort. I would say the thing I realized watching it for this time around is I didn't realize just how stupid most of the people in this pornography business is. I mean, they are really, really, really stupid, right?
Well, stupid or uneducated. Well,
yeah, they think with their genitals, so, you know.
Well, not, it's not that they just think of their genitals. I mean, we have a scene where John C. Reilly does magic in front of Don Cheadle, and Don Cheadle honestly believes that there are evil forces at play in this.
You could find people today that would do that too. So
they're saying that about David Blaine and shit.
But the thing is, Buck thinks that country music, country attire is coming back into fashion. Trying to sell 8-tracks with banjo music.
The country music dressing, he can pull it off, but not putting in like Queen,
he can't,
or even some disco that would sell these. That would show off the speaker.
Well, he's
system.
Trying. He's trying to sell the bass on this TK-427. By the way, who noticed that little? He's trying to sell this TK-421 modifier to the 8-track, and he's using banjo music. one of the least basiest things that you can
classical would work. In fact, it would probably be the best thing to do it.
I would love to see classical on an 8-track. Give me a classical on an 8-track. I want to see that. And we're not talking about the disco remix.
I know I've seen it. Because we used to have a...
I don't want to see no Rock Me Amadeus, okay?
I don't know if that ever came out on 8-track. I don't think so. But, I mean, I know it existed. I don't know if any copies still exist, but you would... I know all the right, Superman right. soundtrack would have been on 8-track.
That's...
Yes.
But the thing is, it's not just a Buck. It's all the characters. I mean, John C. Reilly is wanting to make his post-porn job as a magician. You know, that's kind of taking one step back, so to say. You know, we have, you know, even Jack to an extent, again, he thinks that his artistic vision is a knockoff of supposedly Bond, although I'm really seeing, like, Starsky and Hutch here, right? This is Starsky and Hutch, you know, with one guy with a gun, the other one with nunchucks.
Sure.
Was that Chest Rockwell with the nunchucks?
Chest motherfucking Rockwell.
That is
I will say one thing. That is the best name in this
movie. What was his
movie.
Name? Brock, what was it? Landers or something? Brock
yeah,
Landers.
Brock Landers and yeah. Chest Rockwell. Brock Landers is a snooze fest, but Chest Rockwell, hell fucking yes. Just saying.
I have never seen John C. Reilly like this fucking lean before. I've always seen him with a gut and you know.
It's CG.
No,
it's all CG
in this movie. So.
No. But believe it or not, the thing is if you actually watch him in his earlier stuff, he actually was lean. Yeah. You know, have y'all seen Casualty of War or Casualties of War, the Brian De Palma war film with Michael J. Fox?
I think so.
He's one of the villains in that movie.
I already want to see it.
And
I already want to see it. So.
It's interesting. Well, basically, it's Brian De Palma's version of My Lai. The My Lai incident. It's his take on it with Michael J. Fox being the whistleblower, and it's a pretty intense film. I want to say it's probably De Palma's last great film, which is saying a lot about the movie as well as the career downfall that came after that. I mean, after this, we would get Raising Kane and Femme Fatale and Redacted. I don't want to even think about it anymore. But no, I mean, John C. Reilly, in fact, John C. Reilly was also in Paul Thomas Anderson's first film, Hard Eight, also known as Sydney, which, in my opinion, is the better title. But well, if we ever talk about that movie, we'll talk about that. But you're right. I mean, he is at his leanest. I want to say he's also at his funniest. Reed is possibly the funniest character in this movie, right? I mean, he's loyal to Eddie, or to, I guess, well, can we start calling him Dirk now? I mean, he's
I would have called him Dirk from the start.
Name. That transition where he decides, I see a name and lights.
Well, I love the fact that even the Paul Thomas Anderson shows us that vision of.
It's very 70s or 80s-ish. So.
Mm-hmm. I also love the fake fire in the front. That was a beautiful touch. But there's a reason why I called him Eddie to begin with, and that we'll go ahead and start calling him Dirk. And that's because the one thing that when Eddie becomes Dirk, he just sees himself as Dirk. There's a scene later in the film where he's at his lowest. You know, he is. You know, he can't go any lower, and yet he still sees himself as Dirk Diggler. He refuses to accept who he was. He doesn't return to his given name. Once he gives himself Dirk Diggler, that's the name that he's going to associate with for the rest of his life. And to me, isn't that a little sad? Because, I mean, this isn't even a great porn name. This is, I don't know, whenever I think of Dirt Diggler, I think of a worm. I mean, what do y'all get when y'all hear Dirk Diggler?
That guy in high school that was a sleaze that had, like, a car he thought was cool but wasn't.
Oh, you mean like yeah. Dirk Diggler? What about you, Chris? When you hear the words Dirk Diggler, do you think awesome porn star?
Not really. I'm trying to think of who he reminds me of. I can't remember the name of it. I thought it was Dirk something. Fuck.
Maybe a funky swordsman?
Yeah, I can't remember what it was.
There's a whole lot of other things I'll be thinking about before I think yeah. porn star. But I'm going to say that, in my opinion, the ladies in this movie have better porn names than the guys, right? Because we have Roller Girl. I mean, say what you will about her skill as a porn actress, that's a pretty awesome moniker for a porn star, right? I mean, it gives you an interesting idea, especially considering that she doesn't take off right. the skates. That's her thing. And she owns it, right?
Yeah.
Come on, Chris. Or Ken, why don't you back me up on this one?
Denied.
It's
okay, fine. Very well. But what about Amber Waves?
That one's good. That one's pretty good. I'll give you that one.
I mean, it's... Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was just saying, I'll give you that one. It's pretty good.
I thought Kent was going
to
say something.
It's very American. Amber Waves. Except I expect her to be more blonde than that, but...
Well, Julianne Moore's kind of blonde. When I think of Amber Waves, it's not that I'm thinking about like a slutty porn star. That's a name with yeah. class, right? I mean, that's there's a sense regality, something royal about her, you know. And in a way, she is kind of a mother. And as we see later on, she's also a filmmaker. You know, she gets in on the behind the scenes, and you know, she's and not just this, not only is she doing porn, but she's doing documentaries and she's doing TV. You know, doing commercials. She's probably the one that branches out the most. In fact, I would say that she's actually a better filmmaker than Jack is.
Definitely more ambitious. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah. But, anyway. So, we get our family together. What did y'all make of Dirk's fight with his mom? The one that sends him off to Jack to be his son / you know, money pot.
She was awful.
Yeah.
And totally, I was glad when she wasn't around anymore.
Yeah. But honestly though, is she really that awful?
Yes.
I mean, don't get me wrong, she's drunk, she's angry.
Okay, like,
but
and the second time we see her, it makes sense why she's mad, because he was out all night. He's coming home at, like, the break of dawn. Makes sense. Okay, I get it. But the first time, what the fuck did he do?
Yeah.
When she's, like, doing dishes, just fucking, like, being a bitch for no reason.
Well, as we find out, he quit yeah. school. He is not a very ambitious, outside of... That's the thing. It's like when you look at his walls and you see, you know, the movie posters and the starlets and, you know, the vast amount of Bruce Lee. And, of course, whenever you see him with his fake kung fu.
Yeah.
Very poses, real black belt.
Which.
Yeah.
I cringe. I so cringe. But... You get the sense that he is in love with being mm-hmm. a star, right? Or kind of the Hollywood attitude. And at the same time, he's also thinks that the only thing that he is that he's good for is his penis. You know, and as we find out, he's really not a great actor. He's really not a great singer. No, to say that he's not a great singer is a vast understatement.
I think he's a better actor compared to most of the other porn stars. There's at least some inflection there.
His best acting is that last scene, like before it cuts to black. That's his best acting in the whole movie.
Yeah.
I think that was the point, but you know.
No. I actually will disagree. In fact, I will say that John C. Reilly is actually better acting than he is in the scenes that we do see him as, which is very little. We don't actually see a lot of him in the porn, but we do see him in a couple of scenes. And he actually does pretty good. I mean, he's kind of a buffoon of sorts, right? He actually makes his sex scenes more funny and more goofy. Whereas Dirk is, you know, he basically pulls out the big dick. And the one thing I have to admire about what this film does that's very awesome is they imply his size without actually showing it until the very end, but that's a whole different matter. Like the first time that Roller Girl takes him into the at the club, she takes him into the storage room, and when she's going to perform fellatio, the way that Heather Graham dips her head implies his size. We don't actually see it, but we know that it's big just the way that she dips her head. When he pulls it out at the porn shoot. I gotta give it to John C. Reilly, the way that he dips his head. And did you notice how after he did it, Nicole Ari Parker did the same thing? Is that he kind of let her, that she just followed his lead on that? That was, but all these little, like, my favorite of it was when Robert Ridgely, you know, when he asked to have Dirk pull it out, just that kind of like smile gawk kind of thing.
Just speechless. It was awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say this right now. I love Robert Ridgely. I fucking love Robert Ridgely. If you've ever seen even a handful of Mel Brooks movies, you've seen Robert Ridgely before. He is an amazing comedian. And yet his comedy here is so subtle. He uses very small things here and there to get the comedy across, with the exception of one scene, which sets up for a great final shot, right? I mean, that's the thing about Robert Ridgely. He takes and he just runs with it, and he's so good at that. But I love that gawk that he does when he sees Dirk's dick for the first time. Now say that one five times fast. But anyway.
Oh, yes.
But out of curiosity, before we actually see what it looks like, did you have an idea of what Dirk's package looked like in your head?
I was looking at whenever he was in shorts to see if they were padding it at all. And I didn't see any sign of that. Which I gotta say,
there was a bulge once, least once. Yeah, but after that, I don't remember seeing it like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, the thing was, so when he's in his room for the first time, you know, after he comes back from the club, you know, he strips down to his underwear, and we get the bulge in his underwear. Right. And you have to understand, one of the reasons why I kind of laugh at it now is that Mark Wahlberg was about to say no to this movie. And it wasn't because of the reason that he will give only this year, 20 years after the fact. Just for anyone who doesn't know, Mark Wahlberg is saying that he wants God to forgive him for making Boogie Nights, as opposed to Planet of the Apes or the Transformers movies.
Please excuse my one good film over my realm of shit.
Yeah.
Yes. Because I had a fake rubber dick.
And I have kids now, and it's important, so, yeah.
Yes. We need them to see The Happening than we need to have them see Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Just saying. All right. But But the thing, okay, so, but yeah, that's the only time that we get, like, a genuine,
glance?
Kind of a scale size of what we're talking about here. You know, the rest of the time, it's all implied. It's kind of the way that people talk about it.
How people, their facial expressions as they look at something off camera.
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. The person who talks about Dirk's cock most is Dirk. I mean, he is not ashamed to tell everybody, hey, I've got a huge penis, which I'm starting to think is something that happens with all people that have huge penises. Maybe that's just me. All right. But anyway, so I guess, you know, going, you know, how this film is all kind of driven by, you know, by this kind of wanting to see Dirk succeed, right, and kind of the rise and fall of Dirk Diggler. And I love the fact that Dirk rises really quickly, right? I mean, at the 1977 Adult Film Awards, you know, he takes, what, three trophies?
Three. Because he's three. Seen three on his mantle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I want to say that it's probably like within like 6 months of his first film, you know, because, you know, he's but within his first year, he's probably done, what, maybe 50, 60 movies?
Probably.
Well, I don't know. I don't think they're, Jack's pumping them out. Creating them as fast as during the video era. Because he's,
well, we know,
he's
we know
into
that he...
getting production crews together, and that sometimes takes a while.
Not really, because you're always going to, especially in L.A., it's not hard to find, you know, crew. But it looks also like he assembles a team that works together frequently, because we'll see Ricky Jay is the cinematographer for all the films. Right. We'll see William H. Macy is the production chief for all these films. We'll see Philip Seymour Hoffman as the boom man for all these films until he graduates to a cinematographer later on. You know, the crew stays the same. You know, but at the same time, though, the only thing that they have to worry about is that there's other jobs that they're also having to do, which probably pay better than what Jack is paying, right? So that's, I think, the only thing that kind of impacts their production schedule. And bear in mind that when it comes to porn, it's not like, well, let's talk about Star Wars, where someone's going to go back to the same porn every week. You know, they're probably going to, we're talking about maybe, like, if you're lucky, one week at most before the next movie, because they want to keep these people coming back. No pun intended. But, you know, but do you kind of see that, though? I mean, because we're talking, I think, like, we talked about the Brock Landers movies. We know that at least seven have been made. At least seven. And so, you know, I don't see, you know, I see the rest of the other films that Jack is making are just really quick. They really pump them out. No pun intended again. Just keep pumping. Oh, God, I'm going to hell.
You're fine.
Unlike Mark Wahlberg, I'm not going to ask God forgiveness.
We know what you mean. They're producing the films fast.
Yes, but no. The thing is that, you know, we're talking about a lot of films being made in a short amount of time, which is something that is very common with porn. Right, the average porn star's career is about a year. You know, unless you make a big name for yourself, you're not going to be in it for a very long time, because there's always going to be someone new. There's always going to be someone fresh, and there's always going to be the new superstar that's going to come in and take over, as we'll see when we get to Johnny Doe, right? The thing is that the fact that Dirk has a career that I want to say what spans 5 years, you know, because I believe that he starts off in 1977, And I think 1982 was the year that he gets into the fight with Jack.
Something
right?
like that.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
So that's a 5-year career. That's, you know, that makes him on the same level as maybe like a, well, maybe not a Tom Hanks, but definitely a...
The Tom Hanks of porn.
Tom Spanks.
Maybe Jim Carrey? Maybe...
Yeah.
There you go. All right. You can come up with porn names. But, you know, but the thing is that, you know, he's a big name at the beginning, but I'm pretty sure that as soon as Dirk's Big Dick kind of took over, there's every other porn producer, especially when video comes around, there's other big dicks out there, right? A lot of big dicks.
Always
in the
is. Yeah.
But, What do you think, Kent? Do you see the law of diminishing returns for
especially
Dirk?
Since he's a male actor? Because I'm pretty sure an actress could probably pull off longer.
Oh no! That's the thing. Male actors have longer careers than female actors. Now, bear in mind that especially in porn, female actors get paid more because that's what the That's what the audience is there for, right? They take care of the lady actresses a lot better than they do the males. Now it's still awful. Bear in mind that that's not to say that women had it perfect and nice in porn, but they have it a lot better than the men because men basically are workhorses. Again, no pun intended. I kind of keep saying that throughout this episode. I can tell, but no. The thing is that they're supposed to keep it up and keep it hard for hours at a time, requiring probably chemical stimulation in order to do so. One of the reasons why cocaine was very popular in the San Fernando Valley at this time and possibly ever since, but. The thing is that they are constantly, and on top of that, they have to do scene after scene after scene after scene after scene. Because it's kind of a skill to be able to keep it hard and come on demand.
Especially if they're pushing the leads as the two action stars of porn, Dirk Diggler and Reed Rothschild.
Well, I mean. There is a reason why you have someone like, I lost his name. Ron Jeremy. There's a reason why a guy like Ron Jeremy is as big as he is. And it's not because he's a good looking guy. He is not a good looking guy. But what he can do is get hard on in a second and to release whenever
him
to release.
From my understanding, he also has a good sense of humor, and key point that's going to hit Dirk Diggler, he's easy to work with. Dirk Diggler, when he becomes not easy to work with, that's when it's over.
We can blame it on the cocaine, right? Because before he got involved with the nose horse, he was pretty decent. I mean, he was a nice guy. People liked being around him. He was the star at the parties, but then his mom, or his new mom, decided that he should up his drug game during the 1979-1980 New Year's. Yeah. So same one where we're going to have another incident occur. And I guess before we talk about that, and we talk about the 80s in general, can we talk about William H. Macy and his arc up to this point? Because first off, welcome back, William H. Macy.
Hey.
This is what our third or fourth William H. Macy movie, because we talked about him in Fargo, which was the big one. But I believe we've talked about him a few more times since then. But this is a minor character, right? I mean, overall, he doesn't really play into the story itself, but he does kind of... He's the omen of what's to come, right? He's a victim of the 70s mentality. You know, his his wife has a tendency of openly, flauntingly cheating on him.
Well, is it cheating or is it actually an open marriage to begin with?
Well, he seems upset about it. If it's an open relationship, then he would have no problem and he wouldn't be pissed
even,
off. She's
even if
people.
She's fucking a dude in the middle of the street, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that... Okay, I'll be honest here. That was the moment when I'm thinking that if he was going to do what he does at New Year's, it would have happened.
Yeah.
The fact that she was doing it in another bedroom, that... I love the fact that they're when he goes into the room, we don't see that she's fucking. We just hear the creaking of a bed. We know what's happening. And he walks out, just calm as can be, goes out to his car. I love
he
the fact that he
up.
Locks
yeah.
his car.
Did he leave his drink on the hood, on the roof of the car?
I don't think so. The detail that I thought was interesting is that he goes, gets
locks
in his car,
it, yeah.
grabs something out of the glove compartment. Yeah. We don't know just yet what it is. Locks the car. Now, understand, he knows what he's going to do. He walks back in there, and this, I don't think it's done in a single shot, but it's done in very long shots. Goes back in, opens the door. We hear three shots. By this point, we're moved back to dark. We hear the commotion. You know, William H. Macy comes back out and then blows his brains out. And that introduces us to the 1980s. And I have to admit, this is the perfect endpoint. This is the perfect transition from the good times to the bad. Because after this, everything falls apart. And I also love the fact that Paul Thomas Anderson, after William H. Macy's death, that's when we get the mockumentary. This allows us to see what has happened during the transition. From the time, from up to that point to the current present time, that Dirk has become one of the a very popular porn star, an egomaniac, constantly talking about himself. I also love that he wants to remove the line that Jack says about not staging his own sex scenes. Just wanting to take all credit for the control of his movies, even though he has no control. Develops a really nasty nose habit, even nastier than before. In fact, his drug Reed into this, So now Reed's definitely involved. I also find it interesting that Reed was the one who introduced him to Thomas Jane, right? Or to Tom Jane, as known by Arrested Development fans. But, hey, I gotta throw that out there. But it's interesting how Todd goes from being kind of just a minor entourage member to the guy who's basically scoring all the drugs.
Yeah.
Right? There's a definite transition from minor player to major player during that interlude. Y'all see that?
In his maybe. I don't know about for the story, but in his life, yes.
But. Well, no. The thing is, Todd is actually going to be the reason why all the shit's going to go down at the end, as we'll see. But also, I guess another thing that was set up at the 1980 was that this is the first time that we meet John C. Reilly, or not John C. Reilly, but God, I'm losing it here.
Floyd?
Oh, Philip Baker Hall. Now, this is the first time that we see Philip Baker Hall. Also, I find it very interesting that the way that we're introduced to Philip Baker Hall is the exact same way that we're introduced to the Colonel, to Robert Ridgely, right? With these like really quick cuts, and it kind of sets up that this is the big man in charge. This is the money. This is the guy who's going to finance the porno movies. And also very interesting how Philip Baker Hall is going to come in here and he's going to introduce Jack to the concept of filming on video. No longer working with film, no longer working with, I'm assuming 16mm. I doubt that he has enough for 35. But yeah, the whole idea is that you shoot on video, you edit on video, and because video is so cheap, you just keep rolling, and you don't have to worry about staging. You just get that camera in there, right? No pun intended.
And you just editing's easier in theory. Yes.
And also, I think it's very interesting that when we do come back to the current time, to after the transition, that Jack has started to move on from Dirk. He has moved on to Johnny Doe, right? He has found himself a new, young, hungry guy who...
It's awful, but... Yeah.
Interesting enough, I mean...
He's awful. He's terrible.
Oh, no. The thing is the first time we meet Johnny, he seems sweet, or maybe not sweet, but definitely like kind of earnest. You kind of see a little bit of the Eddie Adams in him, right? He has this kind of nice guy kind of element. You know, the way that Dirk treats him right off the bat is an asshole. I mean, just genuinely awful. And there's no reason for him to act like that. Now, as we see later on, he doesn't have 3 good years and then all of a sudden turns to asshole. He turns pretty damn quickly, right? He doesn't wait at all to let it go. No. And you know, he starts calling women bitch, and he has a very aggressive persona in his performance. Right,
if that's what you want to call whatever he did, then yeah.
Well, it's not rape because, technically speaking, it's still considered performance. Yeah. Unless we actually see someone saying that this was considered rape, I'm going to assume that it's a persona, it's a performance. On top of that, another thing I find very interesting is we also see what we would now consider to be porn. And porn stars. Like, we're seeing massively huge fake boobs. We're seeing no personality in these performers, right? I mean, we get the hot tub with the two lesbian, or what I'm assuming are like two lesbian performers. This is more contemporary, right?
Yeah.
And I also love the fact that we also get a little snippet of what the video, the finished product looks like with the video editing, the transitions and stuff that feel very 80s.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, they're experimenting with new technology and not very well. So.
Well, I don't think it's experimenting. I think they're just basically popping that shit out. No pun intended. Sorry. It's so. I'm not going to say it.
Too easy.
So yeah. Difficult. Okay. Difficult. But yeah. And then we have the huge fight between Dirk and Jack. What did y'all think about this fight?
Completely high. Ugh.
Well,
and you know, there's that's no true. At this point, there isn't too much drug rehab for Jack just to say, hey, taking it to rehab soon. Well,
oh, yes, there is. It's this, early this is the 80s.
But, you know, he could have just grabbed him and said, you're going to rehab, you're going to get clean for a few days, and then you're going to come back. But he doesn't do that. He just kicks him to the curb.
Okay. But we've seen how Jack is when it comes to problems. I mean, hell, Amber has a massive cocaine problem. Yeah. She's had it for a while. It's ramped up. I mean,
for work.
We don't know that because we don't actually see her work anymore. And remember, we're now in the 80s with the fake boobs. Amber is not a part of this wave. I mean, hell, look at what they do to Roller Girl.
Yeah.
You know, when we get to the limo, I mean, you know, she's applying the really slutty makeup. She's wearing I'm assuming it's fake fur. You know, just really tramping her up. Where, you know, I mean, and it looks pathetic on her. I mean, you know, you kind of go back to what she looked like in 77, you know, with this kind of cute girl next door kind of vibe. Now she's all, you know, the heavy makeup, the desperation that it looks like. You know, there's nothing about that look that is sexy at all, right? So I don't see Amber being part of that. I don't see her being involved on in the film side. If she's doing anything, it's on the production side. But we don't actually see her directing porno films anymore. Or, you know, she's not directing porn. You know, she's directing documentaries. And then later on, we'll see her directing commercials. So I don't know. I don't know what her involvement is in porn at this particular point. Do you, Chris?
No, not really. I mean, I always thought she was. I was thinking she was a porn star, but.
Well, no. I mean, she was a porn star. But that was
part of the it's part of the new wave thing. That's what you said. Yeah.
Now, Roller Girl is at this particular point. Roller Girl could be considered the veteran statesman of porn at this point, which is really saying a lot. Because at this point, I believe that she's in her mid 20s. Because she was like 17, 18 in 77. Because she was in high school.
Her and Dirk are the same age.
Well, they don't actually say they're the same age, but...
He drops out of high school. She's in high school while she's sort of doing stuff, so... Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we do know that that Eddie Adams was 17 when he met Jack. All right. So, you know, that gives us a reference as to him. I seriously doubt that... Since Roller Girl was actively in porn... And I do know that there's the whole issue with, like, Tracy Lords, where you can fake your age or kind of tell someone that you're an age, then you're actually younger. But I don't think that Roller Girl...
She's 16. At least 17, 18, right? You think? Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we can agree that she's of age. If I'm not correct, 17 is the age for... Or in 77, the 17 was the age
of... It may still have been 18.
Of consent.
But it brings up kind of a odd point, because I remember when Titanic was a big thing, there was some group complaining that the two characters were underage, and therefore that was a scene that should have had the whole thing banned.
Well,
but here we have at least one 17-year-old in... Dirk Diggler involved in a scene like that.
All right. Well, there have been several movies where we've had, underage girls that are nude. But the way that the Academy or that the MPAA allows it is that there's no sexual context. The scenes like in Titanic, when we see Kate Winslet nude, she's just posing for a picture.
Yeah.
There's nothing sexual about that scene. Another scene is American Beauty. Thora Birch, I believe, was 16 at the time when she had done the full frontal nudity at the window. Spoilers for that movie. But the thing is that there was no sexual context. All she does is she just takes off her clothes. So the way that that is argued by the MPAA is that there's no sexual context. It's just nudity, and that nudity in itself is not a bad thing. Otherwise, you could go back and say stuff about like National Geographic documentaries and stuff like that. And that's kind of how they get away with those. Now, the problem here with Roller Girl is that whenever we see her get nude, it's for the intent purpose of having sex. So, they had to sell it to the MPAA that Roller Girl was of age, right? Because Dirk isn't nude in the scene, so they can argue that while he's playing a 17-year-old, you know, he wasn't the one naked. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong on this. Maybe they got away with murder. I don't know.
I thought it was like, as long as the actor or actress is of age, they can say whatever age they want, and then...
True.
Well, no, because, like I said, Thora Birch was 16 when she did American Beauty. Yeah, she was 16. So, And the way they were able to get around that was because there was no, the nudity itself wasn't sexualized. But anyway, let's get back to this movie, and let's get back to the point that I was trying to make about Jack basically kind of turning a blind eye to other people's problems. Basically, he expects them to deal with it themselves as long as they don't interfere with him. When Dirk decides that he wants to film his shot now instead of in 20 minutes, which we know why, because he just finally got himself hard enough that he can do the scene, and he knows that in 20 minutes, right, he's not going to be hard again. So he's trying to force them to move right now, do it right away, and he's not getting what he wants. And, you know, he's desperate. I think that's the beautiful thing about this, is that Dirk... We understand why Dirk is insisting that it happens now. We also understand why Jack is upset with him. Not just because of this insistence, but because Dirk looks bad. I mean, he looks awful. I mean, there is nothing sexy. I mean, if we were to actually see a sex scene of like this right now, no one is going to be turned on by this. No, it doesn't matter who he's starring with. It's going to look bad because he looks like shit.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and this is the point where he should have said, look, let's get you some help. But no, because he's not interested in Dirk's well-being. He expects Dirk to take care of himself. He pays Dirk. Dirk should, you know, should handle it. That's kind of how Jack sees things. Now, this is interesting because when he gets to Roller Girl, when we get to the limo scene, right? The guy who, you know, the guy that they pick off the street and the way that he, treats Roller Girl, this is the moment where Jack decides that he's going to defend the honor of his star. And so, what do we take of this transition from I don't care to I care? What do we think?
He wasn't defending her. He only did it because the guy fucking badmouthed his work. He said his work was shit. Now, like, his work now was shit. His only good stuff was from back then. That's the only reason he jumped at him. He didn't give a shit about Roller Girl.
But why does he say you're going to treat her with respect? Is he using her as an excuse?
He didn't say that. She did. I thought she said that.
No, I mean, she says that too, but I
don't remember him saying that.
That's a good point.
You know, you might be right. You might be right. I might be confusing those. But she killed him, right? I mean,
he's still moving.
Bash someone in the head with roller skates and they survive.
Wasn't he still moving when we like left him or whatever?
You can still move and have internal head trauma. Concussed. You don't immediately die
brain
from that
dead.
Shit.
Well, that's good. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she clobbered him with those skates. That's blunt force trauma to the head. He's not surviving the night. I'm telling you that right now. But well, at the same time though, she does get to go back to class. So apparently they don't know where those roller skates
have been. Yeah.
So apparently some roller skater bashed his brains in, and she got away with it. And I'm assuming, well, first off, that video that they took was so horrible, pretty sure that even if it didn't, wouldn't be considered evidence to a murder case, he probably destroyed it just because...
Probably taped it right away.
It was a nasty fucking idea
I don't think he would even take... I don't think he would take the chance. I think it went onto a barbecue. Just saying. But... what I find interesting is that so we have three major events happening on the same night, practically at the same time. So at this particular point, we have Dirk at his lowest, right? He has gone years without, or at least a year, completely blowing all of his money on blow, and racking up a huge debt, and now he's turning to prostitution.
Makes me wonder why he couldn't get a job with one of the other producers unless he was just so blackballed by doing that.
Well, I'm pretty sure that it's one of those things that... Okay, so one thing I found very interesting is that during the 1979-1980 New Year's Eve thing, There was a throwaway line that Jack says about that he's not going to use his crew or his stars, which makes me think that he has contracts with them. Now, anyone who knows anything about Hollywood contracts, if you are still under contract and they decide to be a dick,
he could just again, keep no pun them intended, from working anyway as no compete calls.
Well, that's what it is. You can't, if you aren't going to work with me, you can't work with someone else, and I'm not going to hire you, therefore you're not going to work. And it's not as though that Dirk Diggler is in any position to get a lawyer, even if he could afford one. Which is saying a lot, considering all the money that he had and he spent into his pad, which, another thing I find interesting is that when we go back to seeing what his car looks like after his decline and the fact that, you know, pieces of the car aren't there and everything is all torn up. I thought that was an interesting little touch right there. But he's turned to prostitution, which, of course, means that he didn't get to sing You Got the Touch. It had to go to Transformers, the movie.
Which, that seemed rightfully off belongs. That he was singing that, when the song, I don't think it's written for another 2 years.
I think, honestly, it was, I think it was meant to be as a joke. Yeah. Kind of like how Marty McFly was the inventor of rock and roll. You know, that that Dirk Diggler was the guy who wrote You Got the Touch. You know, which is sad kind of little mini achievement there, considering how many people even know that song. But oh my god, I didn't realize until this time just how awful his singing was.
It is atrocious.
God,
it's bad.
I mean, I'm gonna have to apologize to what I said about Russell Crowe even more. Like, oh my god, that's and the thing is that I watched an old Entertainment Tonight interview that Mark Wahlberg had when this movie had come out, and he decided to belt out a few lines from The Heat, the other song that he was singing. And I don't know if he was intentionally doing it or what, but he sounded just as bad in the interview as he did in the movie. So I'm thinking that he honestly thought that he was singing great. I don't think that he realized...
He wasn't just in character?
No, because he was saying how this was the most that he is truly thankful that he had this movie, and that this is a movie is going to be one of the lasting parts of his career.
Has he seen that interview today?
20 years later. Yes, I
see. No, I mean, like, has he seen that interview from then today after he said?
I don't know.
He should.
I don't know, but I'm
totally
Oh boy. But yes, it was very interesting. But before we get to the gigolo scene, what do we think about the fight with the record holder?
That was,
you know,
dumb.
Yeah, like that should have been understood right up. It's like you pay us for the master, we release the master to you. Like that's, I'm saying that's explained right away. So.
But that's the thing though, they won't have the money for the master until they get the record deal, but the record deal needs the master. So now we find ourselves with a catch-22.
They could have sold the car and probably gotten the money for it.
But then they wouldn't have a car in Los Angeles. And let's be honest here, do we honestly think that they were going to be getting a record deal? Even in 1983.
Well, you heard how good they are.
Yeah.
Come on now.
I mean, that's just gold, right?
I think the recording guy was like, you guys suck. But he didn't want to say it.
By the way, did you know who the recording guy was? Michael Penn.
Oh, okay.
Yep. A great musician in his own right. In fact, Paul Thomas Anderson had done a few of Michael Penn's music videos. In fact, one is on the DVD for this particular movie. He had also done some score work as well in several movies. I was going to mention this in the Geek Sheet a little bit, but since we have this scene, and I love the fact that Michael Penn just looks completely baffled that we're even talking about this, you know, or that they were even, you know, getting there. But yeah, I love that about this. All right, so let's go ahead and let's talk about this, and then we'll talk about the big incident. What do we think about the gigolo scene?
Yeah. Do you think he was waiting for his buddies to show up? Or
Yeah. No, this was a lure.
That took
they
a
were
while.
Luring out a gay man to beat up on.
I didn't really understand, like, show me your dick, now you're gay. I don't understand.
Yeah.
Well, I think the whole point was is that he that anyone that would show their penis to
for
another
money?
Man for money is gay.
So, it was weird. Yeah. It was just kind of weird how it played out, I guess.
Well, no, that's the whole point was that, you know, the thing is that this kind of thing has happened before. This is actually based on actual events where you'd have these kind of homophobic guys going around intentionally looking for and affirming homosexuality before beating them up. Like, oh, we want to make sure that they're gay before we beat them up. But yeah, the best way to know is that they'll show us their dick.
Right. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. So, but and on top of that, I also love the fact that this is also kind of combined with Buck's story. You know, that we'd seen that Buck had gotten close to another porn star played by Melora Walters, and that they had gotten married, or that they were on their way from getting married, I'm assuming. Do we get a shotgun wedding vibe off of this?
I think they've been married for a little while. You think?
No. That he's in a tux and she's in a
when
wedding
gown.
When
he shows up there?
So they, yeah. When he's at the donut shop, okay. If you look at him, they're in kind of very cheap wedding attire. Yeah, he's in a tux.
Thank you, sir. I don't remember her being pregnant in the wedding photo.
No, do we even see a wedding photo? The wedding that we see isn't theirs. Okay. The wedding that because they met at Nicole Ari Parker's wedding.
Oh, okay.
You know, she got married to a non-porn guy, and that's when Buck met Melora Walters.
I was getting my weddings confused.
Yeah. No, they were coming from or going to a shotgun wedding. I'm assuming like a Vegas wedding or something. And she's pregnant, and he's going to go get donuts. And then, of course, this is coming off of the scene at the bank. When Buck is being refused a loan because of his porno past. And I'll say that one 5 times fast. But, you know, which is very unfair. But at the same time, though, you got to give it to Don Cheadle. I mean, this is his scene all the way. Actually, both of these scenes are his scene, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. But what did y'all think about the violence? Of this donut shop.
I expected him to die, to be honest. When I'm looking at it, it's like I was scared he was going to be the one shot.
Well, the way that the suspense is drawn to that scene, that's exactly what you're intended to feel. And I just, the way it plays out, the way that it's shot, the way that it it takes its time setting it up, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that I love about this scene isn't actually the violence. It's the look on his face as he's getting the donuts. Because this is a man that's terrified of the future. He's getting married. He has a baby on the way. The fact that the wedding attire is so cheap, you get the sense that he is broke. I mean, purely broke. He probably can't even fucking afford the donuts. And he's terrified. And you can kind of see it on his face.
Well,
and then when the money shows up,
he grabs the cash.
You know,
yeah.
There it is. There's no, you know. Yeah. All the witnesses are gone. And we never actually see him take it, but he took the money, right? I mean, that's how he bought his hip-hop music store, right?
I thought we did see him take it. He totally leans down and grabs it, and then it cuts to black. Yeah.
Oh, you're right. You're right. He does take it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Totally I'm sorry. Shit. He did take it, because then he goes running out, and they get in the car and run off. All right. Sorry. Never mind then. But
it sounds familiar, but I can't.
But then that takes us to the real crime. Now, are either one of you familiar with the Wonderland incident? This is an actual event.
I know they made a movie off of it.
They did. And believe it or not, it's actually because of Boogie Nights that the movie was made, by the way.
Right.
All right. So back in 1980, John Holmes, who was basically what Dirk Diggler is. Dirk Diggler was a fictional representation of John Holmes. He had been a down-and-out he was a huge porn star turned prostitute and had a massive problem with drugs. He and a couple of his friends decide to try to rob a drug dealer, and it goes way, way wrong, and people got killed. All right. In fact, I want to say that John Holmes got killed in the process, I think.
No, he died of AIDS.
Oh, that's right. He died of AIDS, but yeah. It was a nasty shit show. So the sequence that happens with Dirk in regards to going into Alfred Molina's house and, you know, Jesse's girl, that's all I have to say. Well, Jesse's girl, sister Christian, and Nadine Red Balloons. But this was kind of a fictional representation of the Wonderland murders. I have to say this right now. This is easily the most suspenseful scene in the movie, right? The way that it's shot, the way that it's edited, the way that the music changes the tone of the movie, or the tone of the scene with every new song. It either sets up or it exaggerates the suspense just a little bit. In fact, I could do an entire episode on this one scene alone. What did you take of it? Did you feel the suspense of this scene?
I knew something was going to go horribly wrong.
Well, of course.
I think the only person who didn't know what was going horribly wrong was
Todd?
Yeah. Well, and
Dirk?
The brain farting.
Molina?
Yeah, his character. That's right, the only two people not to know something bad is happening.
I'm just going to say this right now. The first three or four times that I've seen this movie, I didn't realize that was Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
I got to say, though, that is one awesome motherfucking stash.
Yeah.
Fucking love that stash. That is a glorious mustache. But, yeah. The thing is that Alfred Molina's character is so coked up. I think aliens could have landed and he wouldn't have noticed. Or he would have cared. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, to say that he didn't realize anything was going on, yeah, that was putting it lightly. But one thing I absolutely love about this is that you think you know how this is going to go down, how this is going to turn bad, right? Because we know that the Coke that they're bringing is baking soda. We know that this is basically just, it's a swindle. We know that that Alfred Molina's bodyguard has guns. That's all set up within the first 3 minutes of them going into this house. We also have Sister Christian playing, which I don't know about you, but that is not a good sign. You know, that's a very, you know, that to me, I don't know. There's something very suspenseful about this song, and the way that they use it here. And then he gets the drugs, and he's gonna get tested. They need to get out. They're not getting out, and throughout this entire scene, it's like, what are you doing? Why are we not going? Why are we not moving?
Yeah.
And then we find out why. Does this make sense that Todd would leave both of his partners in the dark about what his true intentions were?
Well, yeah, if he's coked up and insane.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
But at the same time, though, like when the shit does go down and the guns are going off and people are getting killed, Todd doesn't even remotely think that maybe, just maybe, in the room that has all this money, that there wouldn't be a shotgun there
Well, and he comes straight in through the wide open one entrance. Doesn't even try to dodge out of the way. And like, you hold up in that room. You're going to have the gun.
Well, that's because he honestly thinks that he has Alfred Molina cornered. It's like, he didn't even think for a second. Yeah. I mean, and part of me, whenever I hear the shotgun, I'm thinking to myself about Scarface, right?
Yeah.
The way that Molina just jumps out of that room. I mean, let's say hello to my little friend a little, right? I mean, especially the way that Thomas Jane flies through the air. I mean, shit. He got lifted off the ground by that blast.
Yep.
Sorry. But at the same time, there's something that's really suspenseful. There's something really funny about this scene, right? I mean, here you are. You have the kid that's throwing the little bottle rockets. You have, or the firecrackers. You know, you have, you know, the way that Alfred Molina is like jam into the songs and just kind of getting lost in the music. There's that banter between Dirk and Reed as they're trying to like, they're like even trying to tell themselves like, why are we still here? Just get out of here. You know, I mean, all of this, and especially the way that they go running out of the house. You know, the fact that Dirk basically leaves Reed.
Man, he runs into those bushes and is totally gone. He does not know where to look for him. That dude he's gone, man. The next time you see him, he's a magician.
Like, he fuck that shit, I'm going to magic.
Yeah.
Scared out of porn. That's how it went.
Well, he still has porn in the show. I mean, we do get a naked lady.
Well, I could fear that might have been part of a burlesque show. Kind of the midpoint between... acts where they do something else, so keeps it themed.
Oh, maybe it's a Vegas thing. Who knows?
I mean, he's a halfway decent magician, so yeah.
And of course, this brings us back to Dirk and Jack. You know that are we assuming that this happened like the next day? You know that in a moment of clarity, he decides to apologize to Jack for what he's said and did. Is that kind of what we're led to believe?
If he had the shit scared out of him.
What do you think, Chris?
The next day after the Alfred Molina thing? Yeah. Well, I mean...
they basically just pushed his car all the way up to Reseda, to Jack's house.
It looks that way, yeah. There's no telling. It couldn't have lasted that long after that that gaslight came on, you know? So... you had to push it most of the way.
But what do we think about this scene between Jack and Dirk, though?
I thought Jack was going to knock him out, honestly. There was just like such a long pause, and he like wasn't saying anything. I'm like, oh, he's going to fucking hit him with a frying pan, some shit. Nope, fucking hug.
And we finally get to our last closing shot, the epilogue. Of sorts. We find out what happens to most of the main characters. As the family is reunited, know, there's Jack basically scolding Roller Girl to clean up her room. You know, we see
clean up half her room.
Oh yeah, take the half of the room that's dirty and move it over to the other side. I love that line, by the way. I love how he has Luis Guzman, you know, cooking dinner, you know, or burning it, depending on how you want to see it. You know we have a baby that's in the house, which considering what happens in that pool, I don't know if I'd ever want to have a child in that.
But he doesn't want the kid peeing in it. Comes okay, but baby pee, ugh.
There you go. I also love the fact that Buck decides to get with the 90s by donning the hip hop swag with the totally fake hip hop crew behind it.
Hey, that also was the 80s.
Oh. Going back to Mel Brooks, all I could think of was the Merry Men dancers that Dave Chappelle led in the you know, in the interludes of Robin Hood Men in Tights. Y'all remember? Never mind. Apparently, I'm the only one who has class in this group.
I remember. Sorry. Dramatic effects.
Yeah.
Vaguely, yes.
All right. But the thing is that, you know, it's kind of a homecoming, right? Everyone's home. Everyone's, you know, everyone's kind of made a home for themselves, whether it's at Jack's house or not at Jack's house. And that leads us to one of the, well, I guess before we talk about the really final shot, but did anyone else have a little bit of a laugh at Robert Ridgely getting bitch slapped in prison? I mean, if there's ever a character in this movie that deserved bitch slapping, it was the Colonel, right? I mean, there was something really sad about, you know, when he confesses to child porn, and, you know, are you my friend, Jack? Are you my friend? And Jack just kind of backing away from him. There is something a bit sad, but at the same time, though, so deserved, you know, basically crying his little bitch eyes out, you know, as his very un-PC roommate makes him his bitch. But I did kind of get a laugh at that. But am I alone in this? Am I an evil person because I found pleasure in his pain?
No.
I'm glad. Whew. But it does bring us to the final shot of Dirk in a dressing room that we're supposed to believe. I actually have I have my own suspicions about this, but what did y'all make of this scene? Is this a hopeful scene? Is this a scene of delusion? What do you see this scene
as?
Well,
he's trying to pump himself up and be, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me.
But
it's a little delusional, but I think it's what he needs.
Are you sure? What about you, Chris? What do you take of this scene?
I couldn't tell if he was psyching himself up for a role or just to, like, get back in the normalcy of the circus of the life that he now finds himself in. Because that house is a fucking circus, man. It is a fucking circus.
That house is a fucking circus. The thing is that I always thought that he was actually on a movie set, and because he's reading a script, he's getting his lines, and then he's psyching himself up. There's two things, though. One, no one comes to him and says that it's time to shoot, yet he's preparing himself to go out and shoot. What I honestly believe is that's his room, and the only thing he's being called to is dinner. I think that he believes that this is his comeback, and he doesn't realize there ain't nothing to come back to. The porn world has moved on. He was of the film age. He is not a video star. You know, say what you will about Johnny Doe, that's his territory now. There's no place for him. This is delusional. He doesn't realize that Jack taking Dirk back in isn't because he's wanting to make him a star. It's because he's wanting to get him help. That he's finally accepted that he is wanting to help his family. And that's why he's back at that house.
I kind of think he actually just knows, oh wait, it is time to get on the stage.
Well, we do finally get to see Old Glory. Were you disappointed?
I didn't have to see it, I don't think.
It was all fake. It was all practical. Yes.
But did you know it was fake?
But does Mark Wahlberg still have the prosthetic, like he supposedly had it all this time or whatever?
I had heard it was
fake. I honestly
fake.
Hope that he I mean, still I does.
It is fake, but he, like, kept it.
It is fake. Yeah. It is fake. But the thing is, though, when I first saw it, I honestly thought that he pulled out his dick. Yeah, there wasn't no IMDb back in 1999, or if there was, I hadn't known about it just then. So, and the audio it was only when I actually listened to the audio commentary after the fourth or fifth time that I saw the movie that Paul Thomas Anderson made it very clear. And the only audio commentary he's ever done was for Boogie Nights. After that, he refused to do another, And I think I know why. First off, it's one of the best audio commentaries I've ever listened to. Second to the one for the Silence of the Lambs, which was on the Criterion DVD. Which, if you heard our Silence of the Lambs episode, you know what I'm talking about. Paul Thomas Anderson talks about the things that, not just the things that he did right, but the things that he was trying to do and the things that he got wrong. This is one of the most honest conversations about a film that a filmmaker has ever done with his film. Others try to make it look good. They try to boast it up. They try to build it. Paul Thomas Anderson did such a good job of laying out context for his film that he realized that he couldn't do that for any of his other films because it would take away the mystery, especially considering that the next film he did was Magnolia, which even to this day, even the greatest film minds can't be certain that they know exactly what it was that Anderson was going for and would become kind of the butt of the joke when it comes to Paul Thomas Anderson moving forward. But that's for that conversation, and I'm pretty much guaranteeing that we will be talking about Magnolia at some point. But at this point, were there any other things we wanted to talk about regarding this film before we call it?
What's interesting is noticing the, even though this is made, film is made before it happens, what I'm about to say happens, the shift from film to video kind of reminds me of the shift from video to streaming internet of today. And that, that just almost seems predictive, or just, well, this has happened before. So,
no, yeah. You got a point there.
It's very predictive, and I'm not sure if that, I don't really think that was really happening about the time this film was made, but I think the writing was on the wall that if you knew internet was coming, you knew that was coming behind it.
So. Interesting. Well, what about you, Chris? Anything you want to bring up?
I didn't have anything else, no.
Okay.
All right, Kent, throw us a geek sheet.
Now, what I found interesting is he tries singing You Got the Touch, or The Touch, which is from the, is very known from the original Transformers animated movie. The best Transformers movie, by the way. Which is ironic, because later on, Mark Wahlberg would join the Transformers franchise. Which just seems wrong that he would do that, but that just is a way to start the geek sheet out. Let's see, John C. Reilly has guarded our galaxy before. Not as a Guardian of the Galaxy, but he's in the first movie. Don Cheadle is in half the Marvel movies now as War Machine. We haven't even talked about Heather Graham before, Austin Powers and such. Julianne Moore we've seen before in Lebowski. And was also in Jurassic Park 2, while William H. Macy, we've already seen before in Fargo, was in Jurassic Park 3. Thomas Jane, come on, the Punisher, everybody. Hey. And Alfred Molina was Doc Ock in, well, how many Spider-Man iterations was that ago? Lost track. No, it's interesting.
Yeah. I'm telling you, half this crew has been in a Marvel movie.
Some of the extra actresses are actual porn stars. Little Bill's wife is a porn star. So I don't know if that was just intentional casting or just or reaching out to that community and going, hey, who wants to be over here for a few scenes? So, yeah.
Pretty much. That's pretty much what it was.
So, okay. That's what I got.
All right, well, for me, there's one name that I really want to talk about before we call it a day, which is the cinematographer Robert Elswit. Chris, are you familiar with Robert Elswit's work?
That name.
Robert Elswit, in my opinion, is one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. Elswit has worked on practically so many timeless movies. It's so difficult to go through all of them. He's worked with pretty much every Paul Thomas Anderson film up to, I think, There Will Be Blood, which is the one he won his Oscar for. Was nominated for Good Night and Good Luck, but lost. Let's see, he had done Hard Eight, he did Boogie Nights. That same year, he also did the James Bond film, Tomorrow Never Dies. He did Magnolia. He did Punch Drunk Love. He did Good Night, Good Luck, Syriana, Michael Clayton, There Will Be Blood. He did the Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. He did Rogue Nation. And earlier this year, he did Suburbicon, which I know that I am a huge fan of. Sorry. As well as the new Denzel Washington film, Roman J. Israel Esquire, which is coming out in just about a month or so. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of his work. I think that Ellicott is a genuine master, someone that is capable of using light and just creating atmosphere. And especially when it comes to Paul Thomas Anderson's work, there's something just really unique. And in my opinion, I think Paul Thomas Anderson's best work is with Robert Ellicott, because Ellicott gives it this kind of flash and pizzazz that Anderson's mind works well with. And I don't think that he's found a cinematographer since that has had the same kind of vibe that he had with Ellicott. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, I know that we're running a little long here, so we're going to make this really quick. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Boogie Nights? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
I'm kind of surprising myself here to give it a pass. There were times I felt, oh, gee, where is this going? This seems to be kind of going slow. And then there's a payoff to that scene, that's story arc, and it just keeps building, and you do get the impression that you see these characters changing over time, stuff's happening. I'm curious to see, isn't there like a 3-hour cut of this film?
It was intended to be a 3-hour film. That was what Paul Thomas Anderson wanted, but when he...
I would not mind seeing that cut, actually, just see what extras.
There's deleted scenes on the Blu-ray, and actually, or not, there are some really good ones, including. I'll just mention one. Nicole Ari Parker. Her husband turns out to be violently abusive, Dirk has to go and deal with it, which is actually a great scene, but it also broke the pacing, which is the reason why it was removed from the movie.
I see.
But it's a great scene, actually.
Okay.
And it also deals with something that happens with some porn stars who marry outside of the industry. They kind of look down on the fact that their spouse was a sex worker or is currently a sex worker, and they get violent. But
yeah. Okay. But yeah, that's my eventual conclusion. So.
Chris!
I feel pretty much the same way Kent does. I was feeling kind of about the movie until about the time that Jack and Dirk fight happens, and then like everything after that was just awesome. Love the Alfred Molina stuff. I love William H. Macy. It's a pass. It's a pass. I'll send it there.
Like I mentioned, when I first saw this film, you have to understand, I stayed away from it because I was afraid that it was just going to be exploitation and it wasn't going to be a genuine film experience. It was my snobbery that kept me away from seeing this movie. And after seeing it, I fell in love with Paul Thomas Anderson's work. And since then, he has not disappointed me yet. And yes, I have enjoyed Inherent Vice more than probably most, and I can make an argument for that movie, whereas others would probably laugh at me for even trying.
Yep.
But we'll have that argument. That said, this film is a masterpiece. I cannot tell you just how amazing this film is. It is one that you kind of have to experience for yourself. It doesn't really need me to say much more than I already have. It's tons of great characters, lots of great situations. It pays off in the ways that it's a great movie is supposed to pay off. And in my opinion, Paul Thomas Anderson is the genuine disciple of Robert Altman. And all of what Altman was teaching with his films, Anderson picked up on and he delivered in this film and his other films. But this one specifically feels the second most Altman-esque. Magnolia is his ultimate tribute to Altman, but this is, I would say it's a mixture of Altman and Sidney Lumet, and it's a 70s film that respects the 70s and respects complex characters and complex situations. It doesn't preach. And that's something I absolutely love about this film. So, yes, it's a true pass, great film. If you haven't seen it, go see it right now. And I'm sorry that you got spoiled on all the things, because it's better if you don't know these. But, hey, you roll the dice when you decide to listen to Art House Legends. That said, I think it's time for a slightly chippier type movie.
Is it?
Maybe one, not with my cocaine, but maybe some my cocaine.
Marco Kane actually here has Benny Hill too, but we're going to Italy for a job.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something Italian, an Italian job. Could be.
And this time we're just gonna blow the bloody doors off of it.
Hmm.
I had to throw that out there.
Okay.
All right. So yes, The Italian Job is our next film. I hope you'll join us for that. And if you have anything you want to say about this film or any of the other films that we've talked about on Art House Legends, you can do so through our Facebook page, or you can hit us up at Twitter at Art House Legends, or you can send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. Also, if you have a few moments, go over to the iTunes store, give us a 5-star review. That would definitely help us branch out the show and get more people listening. And who knows, maybe we can put out a few more episodes with that in mind. But thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kurt Kegel.
And this is Chris.
And here.